Well, good morning and welcome to ITE 2, Module 10. We've got a large module to get through today, so without any further ado, we'll get going. And I'll be doing a bit of scrolling because I just want to give you the relevant things to discuss. And today's lecture is talking about the Linux operating system in a lot of detail. We'll be talking all about a lot of the commands that are used, and you know about more about installation and the user interface that you're dealing with, and all your user accounts.
Before we get started, can anybody tell me what Linux is?
Linux is an operating system.
What's special about it?
It's open source.
Well, large parts of it are open source, yes. Not the whole thing. But yes, Linux actually refers to the kernel. It doesn't actually refer to an operating system. So Linux is actually the kernel. Everything else that goes on top of Linux, such as the C libraries and all those sorts of things, is actually part of what we call a Linux distribution. So just an interesting point there. And this course deals with Red Hat. We tend to deal with Debian, although there are Fedora images, and we'll talk about the differences later. There's a text file that summarises those out. All right, sorry, I'll hand it back to you, Geraldine.
No, that's quite all right. All right, now the notes say you can log on to a Linux operating system using a command line interface. Now, Linux also has a GUI interface these days as well. We'll talk about what they want us to talk about to get you through your exams. In the notes, we're talking about the Linux console is referred to as a command line interface, or CLI. So in comparison to, say, Windows 2000 with a GUI, it displays text boxes and buttons, and you get successive text prompts. So you can enter your username, your password, and also additional domain information that may be required. Again, a comparison with Windows 2000, Linux passwords are actually masked completely as their type, and you get the *** that you do in the other logon prompts, so you need to be paying attention to what you're doing because it's not actually telling you what you're typing.
Actually, you get the *** in the GUI, but at the command line you get nothing at all, so you don't know that you're typing. Just to clarify that one, you don't actually see any stars when you type them up in the command line. You get stars when you type your password into TerraTerm if you're SSHing into a Linux box, but if you're actually logging into the raw console, you get no keyboard echo back. You get no screen echo at all when you key your passwords in if you're logging in on the console.
So you don't get stars in your eyes, boom boom.
No, you don't.
Okay, so the command line interface, just as an interface that allows you to interact with the system. And if you were using Windows 2000, you'd be using the command interpreter. So after you've logged on, you then can navigate to your home directory and you would be presented with your command prompt. And the command prompt is just the prompt that allows you to enter text there and to enter the commands that you wish to do so in the Linux operating system. Thank you, Ali. The suggestion is that you don't randomly guess commands because, you know, that you can actually impact adversely on your system. So if you don't know, then you are best to consult in Linux the man pages or the manual pages. But it's just an abbreviation for manual pages.
Just going to make a point here. Because we're using virtual machines, it's probably safer to experiment with commands on the virtual machine, as you're not going to damage any real hardware or any real data. So it is a bit safer for our students to type in commands and see what they do. If you smash your virtual machine, you'll just have to re-unzip it and set it all up again. So just a note to say that when students do this course, normally they actually install Linux natively onto a machine, and if you type the wrong commands, you can mess up the machine and then have to reinstall it again, so they're trying to avoid that. You guys actually have a bit of an advantage in that way, so you guys can be a little bit more blasé with the commands you feed onto your virtual machine.
So when you get to your exams and it says to you, what should you consult if you're unsure of commands in Linux? The answer would be the man pages. And I seem to recall there's something about that in the test. So those pages actually describe all you need to know about the online commands, all your file formats and your system maintenance. And they're actually installed on the Linux operating system by default. And they're character-based, so they're not graphical. Now, if you wanted to access the man pages, you'd need to be at the command prompt, and then you can log in at your command line, or indeed you can open a terminal window in the KDE interface and then start with a command prompt. So they're pretty helpful if you've forgotten how to what commands you need to use, and they're very, very comprehensive. Okay, some of the things that you'll come across in the man pages refer to shells. Yeah, and the shells we're going to talk about more in the lecture, but we're talking about shells such as the Bourne shell, Corn shell, and a seashell, not by the seashore, but the seashell, and the Bourne again shell. And we'll talk about those as we go along. Okay, so now the man command gives you a online man pages. There's hundreds of different commands that are in there, and a listing of all commands gives you with a brief description of what happens if you use that command. So you can actually, for example, enter man intro at the command line. It'll give you an introduction of what is going to be contained there. And if you were using, say, for example, the man command by itself, you could use it to, you know, give you a whole range of commands. For example, the basic form might be man and then name. You'd have a space between them, where name is the command for what you want information. So then it would bring up more information for you. So they're good to play around with, good to work with, and have a good play around on your virtual machine.
Also, just a note to say that most man pages for commands, if you Google for the command name followed by the word man page, you will often get an online web version of the manual page, which is another way you can look them up if you don't happen to have a Linux system handy. And some people may find that a more accessible way of reading the documentation in the web browser, rather than reading it on the Linux system itself with TerraTerms. So there are certainly options there. We also have a thing on our virtual machines called DWWW, whereas if you access the Debian virtual machine, you put in the IP address of the virtual machine followed by /DWWW, it gives you a full searchable web interface to all of the command, the man pages, info documents, and text files that are on the system.
Thanks, Kerry. Okay, so there are a number of different headings that you'll get in a typical man page, and the headings are actually displayed in capital letters. So depending on the command you choose, you can have a number of different headings. You know, so each page that you used would have different headings and different commands that were listed there. One of the most important commands that you're going to come across when navigating around Linux is the ls command, and is a great command to use because it actually lists the contents of your current directory. So once, for example, the man page is loaded for the ls command, you can get various options that will appear. So you can actually
good
for
morning,
example,
all
can be issued with, morning, Elise. You can use it to list the files that are within a specific directory, and that will give you loads and loads of information. Some of your common Linux commands, you can have the command, which gives you a description. Date, as it sounds, would give you the date and time. CAL would give you a calendar of the current month. Who am I? That's WHOAMI, and that'll give you the name of who's currently logged on. That's pretty good, isn't it? The WH O command would give you everyone who's logged on. And there's a whole range of those that you can have a look through in your notes. And also you can Google up to get a lot more of those.
I think O'Reilly actually has a really good reference of Linux commands. I think the link has been posted to the mailing lists a couple of times. We'll try and rat it up again. I think Elise posted it actually a couple of weeks
ago. I actually have one. I'm not sure that it's an O'Reilly one. I'll just go check. It's in my bookmarks. Hang on.
Yeah, and it's got a reference to the man pages and stuff. It's quite good.
Yeah, but certainly have a look at your man pages. Hang on.
I think one of the things that I'd say before we get too far into this module is if you think that Linux is going to be a walk in the park, then it is going to be a walk in the park, except it's a park that you've never seen before, and there are people hiding in the shadows ready to jump out and get you. That is to say that there is quite a lot of learning that you need to invest in Linux to be able to get anything out of it. Some of these things just don't happen straight away. It's not like where you tab yourself to happiness and pull down a menu bar and things just happen. What you have to do is you actually have to figure out how the underlying system works, pat Peter's dog when it wanders over, and also you need to be able to really look at these commands. And we have a student here who happens to own the dog that I've just been patting, who has put a lot of time and effort into learning Linux and has learnt a lot of things along the way about how Linux works and how it behaves itself and what it does. So keep in mind that you're probably going to have to put 6, 7, 8, 10 hours of time into really coming to terms with an operating system that is completely different, although just as usable as the operating system that you're used to in an everyday, you know, Windows world. So
that's really true, and that's where your virtual machines will come in handy.
I think
it's another reason.
Yeah, I was going to say, the same is true if you get a Mac, though, isn't it? It's learning a
Absolutely.
Different way of doing it.
Yeah.
Well, I remember the first night I was sitting in front of Linux thinking, I'm absolutely out of my depth here, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I know what I'm doing when it comes to Windows, and I'm looking at Linux going, what now?
Yeah. And as Kerry said, it's the same with the Mac. You know, you get your first Mac and you sort of, you know, all of your commands that you know with JAWS or with WindowEyes suddenly don't work with VoiceOver. So, you know, but it's certainly worth persevering, and then you may find that you actually enjoy that other operating system.
And maybe you won't. I mean, that's fair enough as well. I
mean, no.
Each to their individual thing. But I think the key...
Horses for courses.
I think the key point to keep in mind here is, though, a lot of people try and they pull open an operating system, say, like Linux or the Mac, and they go, well, why doesn't it do this? And why doesn't it do that? And how come under Windows it does this and under Windows it does that? I think the thing that people have got to keep in mind that these operating systems are very different in their personalities and very different in the way that they interact. It's not like a car where every car drives along the road. There's a vast array of difference between the different operating systems. And I think what it really boils down to is give the systems that you're trying as much of a go as possible and then decide whether you like them or not based on their own methods. We all get tired of comparing Mac to the PC or PC to the Mac or the PC to Linux or Linux to the PC. Try and give each operating system as much merit as you possibly can. And when you're trying to explain these operating systems or use these operating systems in different scenarios, try and keep the opinions and stuff as balanced as possible and see what actual things you can get done under the various operating systems. Now, the biggest selling point for vision impaired people for Linux, just so that we know, is that Linux is free. And you show me another operating system that's free that does as much as Linux does in the accessibility arena. There is OS X Snow Leopard, which is $40 or $50 or whatever. However, you do have to pay for the hardware that goes along it. But you can retrofit, say, a Pentium 3, Pentium 4 machine to hardware, which you can often get, you know, secondhand from somebody who's decided they had to upgrade to Windows Vista and their computer doesn't work anymore, so they had to get a new one. You actually might want to give Linux, kick the tires on Linux, grab a copy of Vinix, have a play with it. It's a very low-cost computing solution, which is especially useful in developing countries and those who are a bit strapped for cash.
Hmm. Now, I'm not going to go over all of the commands because I'm going to get these students to... I'm going to point you in the direction of your notes. Also, Elise was going off to give us some advice on some good resources for commands. How'd you go, Elise?
Yes, I found... Well, I also discovered yet another bug in IE8 while I was doing that, which is why it took me so long. Yes, I've just posted it to the chat screen, and I will read it out
Excellent, thank you.
In a minute. And I've also just posted it to Cavi Discuss. It is, as Kerry says, it is an O'Reilly one, www.oreillynet.com/Linux/CMD. There you go.
Okay, thank you for that.
And it's I'll refer all over it to each of the pages,
Excellent, thank you. I refer to the students to that because otherwise we just sit here going through a whole lot of commands that you're not going to remember, and there are resources available to, including the man pages, to give you information on those commands. So without any further ado, I'll go on to the Linux shells. Now, we touched on those a moment ago, but they act like a command interpreter. So they function much like the in the MS-DOS, there was the command.com program functions, and they launch the commands and control your operating system. Okay, so the Linux shell runs just as any other program does, but it's not integrated into the operating system kernel. Another main difference of the Linux shells is that you can choose from a number of different shells to run it, and you can decide which one suits your needs or which is your preference. So I'm going to go through a few of these different shells. There's the Bourne shell, and that was the original Unix shell. And the program name is put as SH, and is known also as the Bash shell. And it gives you all the SH functions as well as shell programming using shell script files. Now, another shell is the C shell. That is like a letter, capital C. Not commonly used now because it's a fairly complicated shell to work with. Its syntax is for programming with some of the other shells. So it's not really one that's used a lot, except if you're into programming and that type of thing. Then there's the Corn shell, not C-O-R-N, that's K-O-R-N. And it was named after a guy called David Corn. And it gives you a number of interactive type features, so it's quite a popular and it's an easier shell to use. It's enabled by running KSH, and it's not included by default on a Red Hat install. Then we have the Born Again shell. Not Bjorn again, that's Born Again. So as I mentioned before, this shell was created as an enhanced extension of the Born, B-O-U-R-N-E shell, hence it's Born Again. And it's also referred to as the Bash shell and used for a lot of your Unix-like and Linux distributions. Thank you, Elise, just got that email. Okay, as talked about earlier, Linux is able to be run from the command line, and most of its administration is done from a command line, so using a lot of script files or configuration files. And there's an editing tool available in Linux called the VI, that's V for Victor, I for India, editor. And that allows you to edit, as it sounds, all of your configuration and script files, as well as create them as addition to that. So a lot of system administrators use Linux, and it's a very powerful and very stable operating system. Now, if you were working as an administrator, you would be using Linux Server, and you would need to have a good knowledge of the VI editor. Okay, and it would allow you to interact with the system applications.
The reason we there are other editors that are easier to use, and a lot of students are going to jump up and down and say, well, I use Pico, and I use AE, and I use Nano, and I use VI is available on every Unix system that you're ever going to see. Pico is not necessarily available on every Unix system you're ever going to see. The first thing you're probably going to do is to make Pico or Nano available on every Unix system that you're going to work on. But to be able to do that, you're going to have to use the VI editor to edit enough configuration files to be able to fetch the packages down, to be able to bring up the editor that is full screen, and that sort of thing. Now, a lot of students, they will absolutely loathe, hate, and detest the VI lab. It'll be the worst thing they ever did.
Yes, don't they ever.
Oh, and they grumble and they complain and they curse and swear and they're very unhappy chappies. And a lot of them go, well, why can't I just use the arrows to move around? Guess what? Older terminals never used to have arrow keys. These arrow keys are quite modern things. They're like 1980 sort of stuff here. This stuff.
It's so 1980s.
Yes, so 1980s. But like the arrow keys were like totally not there in like 76. So you honestly didn't have arrow keys. Also keep in mind that these are text editors. They are not word processors. They do not do fonts. They do not do styles. And you do your indenting by hand, which is a point that's in the notes there. But they are essential for editing various configuration files. If you think of Windows, Linux as Windows, where all of the configuration files are edited with Notepad, that's basically how the Linux system can be configured, by a whole swag of text files. We don't have this, I'd like to say abomination called the Windows Registry. We actually have configuration files stored in various directories, which can have its own different set of problems, but it can make administration somewhat easier.
Okay, thanks, Kerry. So you've got a number of modes. There's actually three modes that you can use in the VI editor, and they're command, edit entry, and also last line. So it's important to understand those three modes when you're working in the VI editor.
And it's in the file.
It is. And it's, as Kerry mentioned, it's not like a typical text editor. So it's not a word processor text editor. Any kind of text can be typed, but it doesn't function like what you see is what you get, or WYSIWYG editor, which is what Microsoft Word, for example, is. I like that WYSIWYG. So you haven't got any of those formatting commands, okay? And, so the you really need, and we can't stress that enough, a knowledge of the VI editor to be able to work with Linux. Okay, so that's really important.
So definitely don't skip that lab. Definitely do that VI lab and do
absolutely.
Do ask for assistance if you need it. There is also a Linux Introduction Workshop, which is up on the server, and it gives you an introduction to a line-based editor, which is far easier to use with screen readers, called ED. And I'd strongly encourage every student to sit down and go through that that demonstration that we do of ED, and you can edit the text file along with the rest of the students from 2007 and get used to doing that.
And I think that's important too, what Kerry, just to reiterate there, is that, we are here to help. We want you to succeed. Most of us, when we've done these labs initially ourselves, have felt pretty daunted. So, it's normal to feel a little bit that way and a little bit unsure of what you're doing. We're only an email away, or, an instant message away if we're on, or on a Skype call away. So do feel free to get in touch with us with any of this that you need some help with.
Probably also worth mentioning that sadly, when you get into these new operating systems and stuff, 90% of your learning really does occur outside the comfort zone. So do expect a little bit of stress with anything that's new and that you haven't seen before. Always remember that you can walk away from the computer and do something else. And sometimes walking away for a couple of minutes and coming back and thinking about something from a fresh angle or whatever will get you results that you otherwise wouldn't have got if you sat in front of it and got very stressed and upset about it. But people have gone through this course, and I can tell you that other students have passed, so it is possible. It's not an impossibility, but it will be a bit of a struggle if it's not the sort of environment you're used to working in.
Like anything new, isn't it? Okay, so One of the utilities that are available in Linux is the AWK, A-W-K utility. And that's a utility that allows you to create programs, and those programs read input files. They also allow you to sort data and integrate and generate reports. So it's a programming language tool, and it allows you to manipulate text that's actually displayed on the screen. And it's a shell programming language, so it's designed to work in the text processing area, and it's based on a set of executing a series of instructions. So what happens is it actually scans each line of the file, and it looks for a match in the patterns that are those on the command line. If it doesn't find a match, then it goes on to the next line in the programming step, and then goes on and on, and it goes step by step. So it's a very useful command. So you would have, say, for example, you know, you type in awk, A-W-K, and then you would put in pattern plus action, and then the file name. So if you had, say, that command, for example, the pattern would represent what awk is actually looking for in the data, and the action is the series of commands that it gets executed when a match gets found.
Think of a find slash replace on steroids that you can run from the command line.
Yes. And the other thing is that the curly brackets in particular are not always required around your program. But if you have a group of instructions, you'd probably use them. Okay.
For JAWS users, that's left brace, right brace.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, there's also a number of commands that are used with the awk command that I'll refer you to in your notes, because it's just going to go out in your heads if I go on and talk about all of those commands. Okay, so before you actually get into the user and group account administration, it's a really good idea to learn all the concepts and the details you need surrounding all the user accounts or multi-user accounts in a multi-user system. Now, the user accounts in your Linux system allow you to have a number of people logged on to the system at the same time, or indeed at different times, and they can do that simultaneously and they're not going to affect each other. You can also have multiple logins active at any one particular time, you can use and assign multi-user accounts and different groups to be able to use accounts.
Now that multi-user account stuff is really quite useful. So, for example, you can have multiple people working on a particular project on the one machine and share out the system resources. The other thing that is really cool about Linux is because it's so remotely accessible via things such as SSH and Telnet, it is actually possible for me to log into my servers at home, perform commands on them, detach the screen and log back out, and get on with my daily work. So if I have the correct infrastructure set up, I can literally access my servers and stuff from anywhere on the road using a cell phone, a PDA or a netbook, and actually perform meaningful work on them.
Sorry, I'm just laughing at your cell phone. You've been hanging around Grace.
Sadly, yes.
Yes. If you're an Aussie, it's a mobile phone. That's awesome.
I think other people call them cell phones as well, but I know.
Yes, I think they do. No, I was just chuckling to myself then, but I chuckled out loud.
No, that's all right. Well, you're on AutoVox, so we heard the chuckle. But you can, and they're also called handies. If you're in German, it's a handy. Like it's your mind.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that one.
So yeah, from a cell phone or a PDA or a netbook, we can do all of those sorts of things.
Sorry, so I expected them to feel
yes,
like
you can.
Did you end up getting that zone edit stuff, Elise?
Or yes, that was one of the things he called me about. He's just IM'd it to me, so thanks. Plus, he's just put me in touch with Kieran so I can work with him, etc., and a couple of other people about the digitising talking book, so it was all good. He's gone, and I'm gone, and I'm back with you guys. Sorry about that.
No, that's
all right.
We haven't actually got the virtual domain up and functional yet, but I'll talk to you about that after lecture. Elise, we'll work out what we're doing.
That's
there.
That's what I need you to do, yeah, exactly.
Probably all we'll three of us should liaise on that, so we don't have any, yeah.
Yep, sweet, that's fine, we can do that. I'll set zone edit up later on. Okay, we're back to lecture, sorry for interrupting.
That's all right. Okay, some of the terms, and actually it sounds a bit complex when you're talking about it, but when you think about it, it's not too bad. Break it down. But there are a number of important terms that you're going to need to know, in regard to your account administration language. So the user account's primarily one of them, and the term user and account are often used in Linux interchangeably. So, for example, you may use the term to delete an account, or indeed you might put delete you, and you'd hear delete you heard. All it means is the same thing. So delete the user account or delete you account is the same thing, basically. So the term username is a name, obviously, after a user or each person that's actually permitted to log on. And there's a number of rules that you as the administrator can assign to each user and to their usernames. Some of your common usernames are the first letter of the first name and their entire last name. For example, you might have Harry Bloggs and he'd be H Bloggs. And the rules for the username in Linux is no spaces. They are also case sensitive and no longer than 8 characters and need to start with a letter. Now, you often get those type of questions in your exam too. So
can I just comment
when they're talking
on that?
Yes, you can.
Yes, and just as an information for Kerry as well, I've just had my account blown away and re-put back on QCAT for that exact reason. It wasn't Ian who did it, but it was another person with administrative privileges we won't name, insisted on doing it through the GUI and set myself up as Elise Space Lonsdale. And boy, did I have all sorts of problems authenticating into that. So I got Ian yesterday to use the account and make me a new one, which is simply Elise.
Yep.
And I can get in on from the command line on my own Linux machine and obviously from WinECP. It was just a pain in the neck because I didn't even know whether he had it with capital letters. Oh, what? Mm. Oh, I had to escape the space on the command line. I use a %20, which just got too confusing. And I sat there for about 5 minutes trying to authenticate. And I said to Ian, blow the thing away, will you? And he did. So it's not good practice to have spaces in usernames, believe me.
Yeah.
You can actually do it these days. And in fact, one of the problems is that this particular person probably cut and pasted the username in and just hit make, off it goes. One of the problems is that when you look at things, the Mac actually tries to guess what your username's going to be from based on the full name that you paste in, and it'll try and guess a short name, and that can be somewhat problematic. You can actually log in if you're using SSH by actually putting quotes around the usernames with spaces in them, but I've honestly found that it's best just not to put the spaces in the first place.
I think that's how I did get on one of the few attempts I was successful. I think I did either that or I escaped it with the backslash first. I can't remember. It was all too hard.
Pretty much. So, you know,
I'll catch you later, folks.
Cheerio, Leon. You can certainly do that, and I think having the usernames kept fairly simple and short, I mean, if you're going to type these things in, they're not going to be something, you don't want your username to be supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even if the operating system can support it, because certainly typing it would be somewhat quite atrocious, and we wouldn't want to be doing that.
Ha, ha, ha.
Okay, so after you've got your username and password all sorted, you can assign as the administrator access to certain directories and refuse access to other. Your login privileges will sort of really assign what kind of rights the user is going to be granted once they've got on to the system. Along with the username, they need to supply a password to log on to this Linux system. And the password's actually hidden, as we talked about earlier. And rules for passwords, again, it's important to have one that's not going to be easily broken. The average length is 8 characters, but they can be up to 15 characters. Case sensitive, and you probably should have a number of different features like numbers or unusual characters.
I think actually technically these days, because we're using MD5 password hashing, the passwords can be significantly longer than 15 characters, but if you're using a legacy Linux system that's quite old, like Red Hat 7.2, it probably pays to pay attention to the limitations that are placed on the passwords. And if they ask you on the notes, in the test, it's 15 characters.
In the exams, yes, that's right. Yeah. We know that this... some of these, what we're doing in ITE2 is out of date, and we are in the process of upgrading, provided our we have funding for next year, and we hopefully be introducing a more up-to-date whiz-bang course on Linux. Okay, so in your Linux system, each of your user accounts has a home directory. Okay, and the user can have access to that directory, and they can actually, see the files that are stored there, and you as the administrator can actually delete or add files there. There's also a number of numbers or user and group IDs that are used to identify a user or a group. In Linux, they don't use names, so the operating system uses numbers, and so you each have a user ID or UID. And if you have a member of a group, you'd have a GID or a group ID to identify the group.
And if you're using JAWS, that's a UID and a GID, just so you know.
Yep. So when you actually log on to Linux for the first time, the commands will be entered at the shell prompt. So if we're talking about the shell prompt port there, it would be the default shell prompt. And that is used to interpret the commands you type in to the Linux kernel. And you can have, but the first one you come to is going to be your default shell. Okay, now Linux is both a multi-user and a multitasking system. That is a multi-user and a multitasking system. Please remember that, because that's in your test. So what we mean by that is that as in the nature of Linux, the user accounts enable you to have multiple people, hence multi-user, logged into the system at one time. And they can be logged on in a local manner or in a remote manner by way of a network. So for that reason, Linux is a multitasking system. And what I mean by that, it can be used by a simultaneous people or users at the one time, and they're going to obviously need network connectivity to do that.
Or they can be wired in through terminals on serial lines. But, I mean, the key point here is multi-user multitasking. Windows, unless you're running such as Terminal Server or Citrix or whatever, which are third-party programs, are not multi-user. You only have one person using a Windows box at a time. Even if you VNC into it and somebody's sitting in front of the keyboard, it's still only one user account that's ever active at any one time. Fast user switching was to make it, under XP and Vista, was to make it look as though multiple people could use it, but all that happened in fast user switching was that all of one user's stuff was stashed out into swap, the other user's session was pulled in, and then when the other user switched back, their stuff was stashed in swap and the other user was pulled in the original user. So it really is a single user operating environment on Windows.
Mm. Okay, but just bear in mind though that although Linux is a multitasking system, you know, it's it can't support unlimited numbers of simultaneous users. So if you've got a number of people logged on to the system at any one time and they're all attempting to use the same program, you're going to have a decrease in the performance that's available, as in most systems. Okay, the actual amount of people or users that can be logged on to the Linux system at any one particular time is going to be influenced by a number of factors, and that's going to be the type of computer that you're using, how much CPU, RAM, and all those types of things that it's got. So if you've got a faster system, more powerful, more memory, obviously you're going to be able to have more logged on at the same time. Another term that you'll come across often in Linux is the super user account. So the it's probably your most important user account on the Linux system, and it's also referred to as the root account. And that account is actually created by default when you're installing Linux, and it's used by your system administrator when they're wanting to do administrative tasks on the Linux system.
Now, I was going to say, on your virtual machine, you are the system administrator. So when it says consult your system administrator, it's time to do a bit of internal soul searching and figure out what you're going to do, because you are the administrator of your virtual machines.
And you probably also are in your home network. You're also the system administrator, because if it breaks, you've got to fix it. So, okay. I found that quite daunting the first time I realised I was the network administrator in my own home. I'm like, oh my goodness, I got to fix this. Okay, so you can use the super user account a number of ways. You can have the root login, so you can have the root account used to log into the computer from your main console, and once you're logged in, the user then is, will be doing the commands at the root account. You can have the SU, that is S for Sam, U for up account, and that can be used to temporarily acquire super user privileges. You can also use the sudo, S-U-D-O, and that allows the system administrator to select commands that can be entered without having to be the root account. And there's more information on that in your notes, which I'll refer you to, because I think this sort of thing you've just got to keep playing with. But another one there is,
It is tempting to say sudo. And that's what JAWS will tell you. It is actually sudo, because you're going to do something as the super user. It just isn't spelt particularly well.
Yes, which is true, yeah. And then there's the suid, S-U-I-D, like squid without a Q, S-U-I-D. And that allows you to select a file to execute, and it does that as if it was run by the root. But it can be actually executed by any of the users that are on the system. Okay, now, just a word of caution when you're using a super user account. You can run into security issues. So for that reason, it's not recommended that the root account be used as a regular account for users on the computer.
Some users think that they'll just use the root account, and they go, there's so many things that I need to do as a super user, I'll just log in as a super user all the time. And all I can say to them is it only takes one wrong mouse click or one wrong key command, and you can wipe out an entire system as the super user. And I've actually seen people do that on Windows systems when they've operated as the administrator and done something particularly silly, and it's taken the whole system down. The same thing applies for Linux. You don't want to be operating the super user all the time, because it's, with great power comes great responsibility or something.
Okay, with your group accounts on your Linux system, they're used for much the same purposes as in other systems or operating systems that you might be using. So you're actually grouping together accounts or user accounts, and they're grouped together to an ID or a group ID, GID. They are not, however, user accounts. They're a means of grouping together a collection or similar users for example, for security purposes. So some of your important terms that are used in your user account would be things like the username, who has logon privileges, password protection and permissions, user and group IDs, default shells. There's a whole range of them there you might want to have a look at. Now, the first user account that you create using a Linux installation, as I mentioned before, is the root account. And the super user account is used by the administrator, and they use that to create all of the other accounts on the system. Okay, but by default, and it's done because of security reasons, no other users have the power to add other users except for the root account. Okay, so the process of creating a fully customized Linux user can be reasonably complex. All right, so there are again a number of notes there. I'll just go through a couple, but you might have the U and then add command, and the what that would do is the root user would create a user add command, and then they would then be able to add other users. Now, another one you might come across is the PASSWD. Obviously, that's going to be creating a password account. And you've got a number of others, U, delete, or DEL. So there's a number of them there you can have a look at, and also you go and do a little bit of exploring and have a look at the number of commands you could use. Now, when you've got a Linux command line interface, you've got text commands, as we've mentioned before, you've got to be able to understand how to use those text commands. Now, in Linux, for example, your user passwords are stored in a file known as the shadow file. Are you catching up? Yeah, I've just skimmed down a bit. Oh, okay. Yep.
Okay, there we go. We should be back to less delay. I've just killed the web server, which will upset people looking at books without barriers, but until we get some throttling in place, we'll have to just continue to do that.
But you get that day.
There we go. We've now lost our 7 seconds of delay.
Oh, better. Excellent.
And you're just saying that we're using the etc. password and the etc. shadow files, so I'll let you get on with that.
Yes, that's right, yep. So the shadow file stores those passwords. Okay, now we did touch on a little bit earlier, we were talking about VI editor. Now, Pico, Kerry I think mentioned Pico before, is another text editor, and it allows the use of the arrow keys, the all-important arrow keys, to go through your lists of user accounts. You actually have your user information listed continuously on a single row with a colon separating each field. And the first field would give you the username, and the second is the user's encrypted password. If you wanted to, for example, to disable the account, you could place an asterisk at the beginning of the encrypted password, and that would make the password impossible to correctly enter when someone was logging in. Now, if you wanted to save your shadow file, for example, so to save your password, you would press Control X to quit Pico, and then press Y to save the changes. Some of the other commands that help you manage and control security, now there's a range of them, but I'll give you a couple. You've got the change of username, and your syntax for that would be user mod dash one, then space new name, and then old name. And anyway, you can have a look at those, I think, because if I sit here and waffle on about all of these commands and that, it's just going to go in one ear and out the other.
There are some good ones that teach them to you.
Yes, that's right. Until you start doing the labs,
in your IT2 course, you'll learn a lot about the commands, I can tell you that.
And there's what about 62?
Labs, I have a question.
There is quite a few, yes, 62 all up, I think, 40-something or other labs in some of the worksheets. I think it's 32 in total.
Yes, Grace, go on.
Okay, so I wanted to know, wouldn't you just delete the line with the username to get rid of the user's account?
What about the home directory? And what about any group memberships that they're a member of? If you delete the line in the password file that contains the user record, you've then now told the system to forget about user 107, say for example. If you then create another user account and the system decides to reuse user ID 107, you'll find that all the files that were owned by the user that you deleted are now owned by the new user that you've just created. So say Alice was 107, you delete Alice out of the system, you recreate a user called Bob, who's reassigned 107, all the files that Alice used to own now become owned by Bob, and then it then becomes difficult to find where all of those files are owned in the file system. No, I'm just finishing off the sentence. I realise you've got me about 10 seconds ago, but you do need to, when you actually do a user del, it actually takes out the username line out of etc. password, it takes out the group memberships out of etc. group, and it optionally also clears out the home directory of that particular user. Mm.
She was talking about the slash thing, and I was just wondering if that was the only way to get rid of a user is just to disable it, and you couldn't get rid of the rest of the stuff.
Oh, no. A couple of commands and a little bit of frantic typing, and I can delete you off every system I own quite easily. Not that I would actually do that. but yes, you can actually clear the records. What she was talking about was disabling a password. And sometimes you do that for security reasons. So say, for example, we have a big fight and I'm in the doghouse and you're not talking to me anymore, and I decide that I don't want you having access to my systems because I'm a bit upset, I can lock your account, which means that later on when we make up, I can then unlock the account and you can have access to the system again. I mean, that's a silly example, but in a business situation, have reasons for wanting to disable an account for a period of time because you don't want to leave accounts open to people who shouldn't be logging into them at any given time. Sorry, go on, Elise.
A good business business scenario would be is if an employee goes on maternity leave or it leaves the company for an extended period of time.
Yes.
But they know that they'll be back. We don't want to set up the user account and put them all back in whatever groups they had and then make sure they had permission to file, just disable their account while they're away and re-enable it again when they return.
And in fact, ISPs have a policy of if you don't pay your bill, they will disable your account, leave the account still in the system, and if you pay the bill within 3 months or whatever, they can just reactivate your account and all your mail store and all that sort of stuff comes back, whereas if they were to delete the account, you'd lose all the mail store and stuff. And the same holds true under Windows NT systems. If an account's not going to be logged into, you should probably disable it as a security measure.
Yeah, exactly. So, you've got the administrator from business. You're going to, you've got a huge responsibility on keeping security up to date and fairly tight. Otherwise, you're not going to be very popular if someone gets into all your information or your business information.
Well, some people actually go out and they think, well, I want to be an NT administrator or I want to be a Linux system administrator because it pays $50,000 to $70,000 a year and that's sort of the money I want to live on. What they don't realise about these job descriptions is that there is an incredible amount of stress and responsibility involved in being a network administrator. Now, we're not trying to dissuade anybody from being a system administrator, but keep in mind that you are responsible for people's data, you are responsible for people's livelihood, you are responsible for maintaining security, you are maintaining information integrity, so no pressure.
No pressure at all, no. Okay, so we talked a little bit about creating groups and adding users to groups. So on your Linux system, you can have anywhere from no members of a group to as many members as you've got user accounts on your systems. And group membership gets controlled by the etc. group file. And that's a file that's got a list of all your groups and also a list of all the members that are actually in that group. So when your users log in, they would log into their primary group. And that primary group that I'm talking about is just the group that specifies or is the default group membership and is set in the user's configuration file. Once they get logged onto that particular... Yeah.
Is that okay if you can't be bothered remembering how to append groups in on the command line? Is it all right to go in there and just simply hammer the person's name into the appropriate group in etc. group?
Yes and no. If you have a true multi-user operating system, no. If you're the only person who is working on that system at the time and you can be assured that no other file is going to touch those files while you're editing them, yes.
Follow you. Yep, fine.
Okay, so as I mentioned, when the actual user logs onto the system, they'll log into their primary group. And when they get into their primary group, they can access the files and run programs that are actually associated with that group. Okay, so they can't, if you've got group A, B and C and they're a member of group A, the administrator's already set all the rights for group A and privileges, what they're allowed to access. They can't access what's been assigned for group B or group C. So if they're not accessing files in their primary group, they need to be able to switch group, okay, and they would have to get the administrator to change that. So it's a security measure as well. And the Linux system, the super user or the root account has the power to, and is the only one, able to create and manage groups, okay?
And as an interesting point, I just make an interesting point here, you have all sorts of organisational and conflict problems if you have more than one system administrator, which is an issue we're currently dealing with in our organisation at the moment. It's very difficult once you have more than one person acting in an administrative capacity to make sure that you don't step on anybody else's toes. So keep that in mind if you're setting up these sorts of systems and stuff. Who should have what level of power and how many administrators should they be, and is everybody going to behave responsibly and in a manner that lets them easily work with other people? And this goes for any operating system you're running.
Well, I think in our case we're going to have an administrators list for one of these machines, which is a good idea, so keep your other administrators informed if you are happening to be not the only administrator.
That's right.
Now, if you're wanting to sort of create or share directories in Linux, again, it's a matter of knowing your commands. You don't have to have them all rattling in your brain, but eventually you will, the more you use it, like anything else, like the JAWS commands when you're learning it, or the WindowEyes commands, the once you start using them, they start making a lot of sense, but when you just hear them, and that's why I'm not going to go through a lot of them, then you know they don't get stuck in your brain until you actually start using them. So do your labs along with your worksheets, and that will reinforce a lot of what we're talking about.
Just a point that try and remember back to when you first started using Windows and it was all big and scary and you didn't know how to use Microsoft Word and you didn't know how to use JAWS and you really did press insert F1 every now and again because you couldn't remember what keystrokes to press. That's what it's like when you go into a new operating system like Linux. It will be a bit of a feature curve that'll take you up there. And it's interesting, if ever any of you have the chance to do this, to actually take people who've never used a computer before through various procedures. Not only does it test your patience and your stress levels, but it also makes you think about the way you describe and explain various concepts and things that you take for granted. I, for example, had no idea. I was doing some training with somebody back in 2000. I had no idea that the ICQ icon was a flower, and that the flower was either open or closed as to whether ICQ was online, and I didn't understand what the elements on the screen actually looked like, so actually training a sighted person was quite difficult. And one of the challenges of teaching my mother how to use Windows is not that my mother is silly or stupid, because she's certainly not. She's a wonderful woman, but she doesn't know what the maximize button looks like, and she doesn't know what icons look like, and she doesn't know that you click on the little arrow of the hammer or whatever it happens to be. So a lot of the actual effort is actually teaching the underlying components rather than the actual procedures. And Yeah, anyway, we'll stop that diatribe just to say that some people actually learn things as a procedural-based thing. Be careful about that, because it's all very well to know that you press Alt-F, Q, Q, P, Enter, Enter, Space, Tab, and then right-click your mouse button and belt the Enter key. But when you upgrade to Office 2007, all that went out the window, and all of those keystroke commands you carefully learnt just got eaten. So just be aware of that, things do change.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in actual fact, somebody I've been training has been doing that, and I've been asking her not to, because it doesn't even matter, even if you're not upgrading your software. If you get a variable and halfway through going, you know, enter, enter, QPX, whatever Kerry said, and the right icon or dialog box doesn't appear on the screen, that variable is going to throw you right off track. You must really learn it. Don't do it by rote.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. One of your fairly useful, I'm going to touch on a few useful commands, though, is the find command, F-I-N-D. And that's an important file management utility that you have in Linux. And as it sounds, the find command is used to find things. So it locates your files, and it's worth understanding that it does a lot more, though, than just locating your files. Of course, it lets you do things like specifying filters. You can run commands on the contents of, like, an entire directory or entire directory tree, as we refer to them in Linux. And it's a great tool to use in Linux. Okay, now...
I'm just going to make a point here. When you're looking at these notes and stuff, it may look as though there's a find command, and there's a user mod command, and there's a whatever else command. And you go, how many commands are they? I think one of the things you've got to keep in mind about the Linux operating system is it's like a really big 300-piece toolkit, and you've just got this big shelving unit that's in bits. So not only do you have to figure out how the shelving unit goes together, you also have to figure out what tools you're going to use on the shelving unit to make it, to be able to put it together. And the key to Unix is power, and its incredible simplicity and complexity, is that you actually have to figure out what tools you're going to use for the job, and then assemble those tools into a useful set of procedures that will get that job done. I have been... accused in times of being a freak, which I resemble that remark, when I've just gone, why don't you just do a find dot dash name bar grep back quote tilde blah blah, and people just look at me and go, yeah, we should have thought of that, but it's just...
Well, another command that you might find very useful is the grep, that is G-R-E-P command. And what that command will let you do is to search for a pattern that occurs in a list of files. We refer to those patterns as strings, and think of them like a fragment of a sentence. So it looks for a string, and the way to search for a string with the grep command is to put the words you're looking for in single quotes, and then you'd use the command to look for them. That's just a couple that we'll touch on there. Okay, the Linux system works on permissions, and you, as an administrator, are going to have the control of assigning those permissions. And you'll be looking at permissions such as read, write, and execute. So, it's in Linux, you have... two separate permissions. Okay, so there's the execute permission controls, which will allow you or your users to enter a directory, read permission controls the readability, and obviously if you've got execute, you know your user would be able to execute commands. Another command that related to file permission is the chown, that is C-H-O-W-N command. Chown? Chown?
Chown. Yep. It's change ownership.
Chown.
That's okay.
Chown.
Yeah. So you've got file and directory permissions are used by the chown and chmod. commands. If you were using the change permissions, as Kerry just mentioned, you'd use that command. Now, the chmod command is, for example, used when you've got file and directory ownership, because the permissions get declared for both the users and the groups based on that ownership. It's also a very useful command. Now, the in Linux, the three permission types, that's the read permission, the write, and the execute permission, are given a numerical value. And for those commands, you have the read, which equals the numerical number 4, write is number equals number 2, and execute equals number 1. So if you were assigning those permissions to the users, you'd have to use the appropriate number and list it in the proper order.
Just a point there that the 4, 2 and 1 add up to 7, and this means that when you actually give your permissions, they're actually given in octal or base 8. Just in case you've done binary and base 10, we're now going to have a very swish past octal, and that handles things from 0 to 7. So for example, 0 would mean you had no permissions, and 7 would mean you had read, write and execute, or 4 plus 2 plus 1.
Okay, now with Linux, when you're assigning permissions, if you wanted to stipulate if a user has write permission, for example, on a directory where they could sort of modify or delete files, then Linux has a way that it uses to assign those type of permissions. So the owner of a directory can set what they refer to as a sticky bit attribute. So with a sticky bit attribute, the only people who can rename or remove a file in a directory are the file owner, the directory's owner, or the root account. Okay, so there is a lot in your notes there about using the sticky bit permissions. So I'd refer you to your notes to go through those. Lots of commands there. Okay, now two commands that are also used in Linux is the mount and unmount file systems and partitions. Now, the syntax for the mount command, you'd have mount, then the type of file, and then your options. Have a look at that in your notes, and also you'll be playing with that in your labs. Okay. Now, when you're using, again, there's some input there on the unmount command, and there is a example there in your notes of the unmount command.
Now, just a point here, you'll all be very happy to hear that under the Linux GUI there is what we call the GNOME Auto Mounter, and it handles automatically mounting and unmounting your media for you when you click on the eject button and all that, so that'll make all your Windows users happy, except for when it all busts and goes pear-shaped and you end up using the mount command from the command line. So just be aware of that. Ever been in a situation under Windows where safely remove hardware won't work? Well, under Linux you've got a way of forcing it, which you don't under Windows. It just tells you that the device...
A little bit like the Mac with force quit.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay, so another command you'll come across is the df command, and it's a command that's used to help you manage file systems in Linux. It can be used alone or in combination. Yeah, that's true. Another one is the du command, and that's another one that can you use to find information about directories.
Just a point. Okay. Disk usage. That's right. Have you ever used df-h, Elise, in your travels? I find that very handy.
Oh yeah, it makes it human readable. Df-h makes it just simply rounds it up to the gig or the megabyte. So if you've got a 500 meg hard drive, and you go df-h on it. And you can see how much, it just rounds it up. You might have a 500 gig hard drive with, 450 gig of data on it. And it just makes it human readable, hence the dash H. And the dash H option also works on DU, which is disk usage. And if you do that on a directory, it tells you how much of that directory is taking up how much disk space that particular directory is taking up and its subdirectories.
That's right. The other thing you can also do is you can, I've actually found with df-h, I've had a little kvite with that, which is a bit of annoying. If you just do df-h on a system that is terabytes big, it'll often give you the units in terabytes. So it'll say you've got 1.6 TB and 1.4 TB is free, which isn't particularly useful. You can also go df --h --m, and that will actually give you human readable output in megabytes, which might make more sense to you because a terabyte is in fact quite a large unit.
That is handy to know. Thank you.
Now, you've got two types of configuration files in Linux. They're your user and system configuration files. Now, your configuration files have got all your information that your users have, and they have information such as your icon placements, your management preferences, and scripts that are you're setting to run automatically. They're an essential component of your system or your multi-user system. So they got information about the configuration files. Got information that controls all your settings for your system. Okay, so you need to know how to find them and to edit those files when you're working as an administrator even. I'll say that again. Your user configuration files, as I said, control your settings for each individual user, and they're stored in each user's home directory, and they're stored as a .dot file. Now, what else did I need to talk about there? Okay, your system configuration files, as they sound, they are the files that relate to the operating system. And, you know, they are obviously different from the configuration files in that way. Your startup configuration files, obviously as it sounds, is utilized at startup and is the init, I-N-I-T, program. So in your etc. initab configuration file, it would store the settings on how your system would start up. Now, your system configuration or function configuration files would actually control the functions as it sounds, as it's being booted up. Okay, and if you had, say, for your configuration files for a specific server, they would be located in your etc. directory as well. And those files would, as it sounds, run in the background and be configured for the server, okay? And for the server would just seamlessly do that for you. When you're editing configuration files, it's important that you understand the difference between the user and the system configuration files, otherwise you're going to be in strife. And you'd need, as an administrator, to be able to edit those files to configure the system as you wish to do so. Now, keep in mind that the files can be edited using any of your text editors, for example, your VI editor, and you can go to your man pages if you want to find information on the commands you need to use. Okay, now another important aspect of Linux administration is run levels. Now,
should I whiz through this bit?
Okay.
Run levels are basically levels in which the system can run, that's why they're called run levels. One is what we call single user run mode, which means that only one user is logged onto the machine. 2, 3, and 4 are run levels that allow you to have different sets of daemons started or stopped depending on the run level that you're in, depending on how many, usually higher run levels have more stuff running. And I think run level 5 starts the graphical user interface, if my memory serves me correct. So if you tell init 5, that will actually start up the graphical user interface. Now 6 is reboot and 0 is halt, if I'm still...
I'm getting a bit grey on these myself. One of those isn't used, Kerry. I thought it was 6, but I might be wrong. I think one still isn't used.
Okay.
Google this up.
and you change the actual run level by using the telinit command, T-E-L-I-N-I-T, which tells init which run level to switch to, and sometimes you can bring the system down to single user if you're doing maintenance on the system that would require certain things to be stopped. And for example, I don't know, just to make a silly example, because she happens to be here. Say, for example, Grace is updating her music collection on the server, and I've decided that I need to do some maintenance on the underlying file system. I can actually bring the user system down into single user mode to stop her from editing her music collection, because it'll kill the Samba demon, which will knock her out. She'll go off and make a cup of peppermint tea whilst I do the file system maintenance, and then we bring the system back up into multi-user, and she can get back renaming those pesky artists and titles of her music collection.
It's lovely how you get roped in around here, isn't it, Grace?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now, when you're working as an administrator, now I don't care whether it's in Linux or Windows or Mac or whatever, the important thing when you're working in that area is to make sure that any changes that you make to the configuration in your system, you document. Document, document, document. Because otherwise you're going to just find it impossible to keep track of all the changes that you've made. And if you need to refer to those changes because you went and changed it again and you thought, no, I preferred the original configuration or the previous one, how the heck did I do it? You're not going to know unless you've documented it. So a lot of administrators will use a log to keep track of those administration changes. And I would suggest that also when you're doing your configurations, make sure even right from the initial configuration that you keep a note of what you're doing, okay? Also keep a note of any software packages that you install, any edits you do to your configuration or your file system, and if you've got to ever recompile the Linux kernel or upgrade it, make note of the changes, hardware changes. Another thing to do is to make backups. Before you make any changes, back up your information on your configuration. Otherwise, you might be sorry.
Just a point here, and we all don't like to think about it, but there are times when either things will happen to you to undergo a significant amount of stress, which can affect your memory. There are various health problems that can affect your memory. I'm not going to name any names, but I've had a situation where somebody I knew quite well went through some quite significant mental trauma. And one of the things that allowed that person to be able to continue administering their system was that they had made sufficient documentation and they could actually read back over the configuration files and remember what was done 6 months ago. Also, no one is indispensable, so sometimes the next person who might be taking over your job might need the documentation that you made.
Exactly. Okay, now, in Linux we have daemons. Okay, or demons, however you want to say it. Tomatoes, tomatoes. Yeah, so anyway, Novell, for example, refers to services as network loadable modules. And basically a service or daemon or network loadable module all perform essentially the same task. What they do is they enable your operating system to function or provide functions like or services like internet, file sharing, your mail exchange, directory services, remote management, all those type of things are managed, and in Linux they're managed by daemons. If we're talking Windows, they're called services, and in Novell, as I mentioned, they're network loadable modules, and in Linux they are daemons. Okay, now a couple of Linux daemons are FTPD and HTTPD, and the daemons are not integrated into the operating system as they are in Windows. So they're run as a background process. Yes.
For you, Elise, who may have something open that could check this, is Apache still called HTTPD, or does it actually show up as Apache in the process list? Do you remember?
I think it's still called HTTPD. That's what I used to start it anyway.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I'll probably is on the Debian systems too. I can't imagine why they wouldn't have changed that. So it's HTTPD.
Now those daemons are actually, as I mentioned, going to run in the background, and what they do is they'll get the incoming requests, and then they'll send out the files that are required. The activities of all the daemons are recorded on a log file, and as we've mentioned a couple, the HTTPD, and that is actually responsible for your web browser requests. You've also got one called initd, and what that'll do is it'll wait for an incoming request to be made, and then it'll forward that request to the next appropriate daemon. The crond runs scripts, and the syslogd, as it sounds, will run programs to the system log. And you can actually have daemons loaded or unloaded to memory at any particular time. Now if you wanted to start or stop or restart, for example, a daemon, so for example when you've got a Linux system and it's running, you might only have the login prompt that's showing, and there's these daemons working in the background. Now they'll often need to be started in some way, and they may need to be stopped or restarted. So there's a number of ways you can do that, and sysv scripts are going to enable you to start, stop, or restart a Linux daemon. And they are located in a particular directory, and mostly that will be the etc.rc.d and the init.d, or they may even be in the etc.init.d directory.
Recently, that actually has a link from rc etc.init.d to etc.rc.d init.d. Try saying that 10 times fast.
Yeah, and as Kerry... yeah, go on, Kerry.
let's not.
Okay, now, as Kerry mentioned, it'll be dependent on the particular distribution of Linux as to... which way you need to type that in, and you could permanently start or stop that daemon as well, and you do that with your sysv scripts. Go and have a look at your notes because there's a lot more there on that, and I'm just scrolling down to get to the next point we might need to talk about. And that's another way to automatically start a daemon when your system boots up, and you would use the text in the etc.rc.d, rc.local script, and that's script would allow you to start any of those daemon services. Now we touched on HTTP, and Linux is actually not capable of providing HTTP daemon to you, and you can actually use a popular web hosting program called Apache as a solution. And what Apache does is it gives you the same
HTTP
daemons. That's an Indian for anybody who doesn't know.
We do it every year.
Yeah, no. The daemon for Linux, that gives you the Internet Information Services tool, or the same as the Internet Information Services tool that you would have in Windows. So Apache requires an understanding of web hosting and security issues as an administrator. And you can have a look at the... information that's in your notes on that. And Apache's...
I was going to say, or you can go to www.apache.org, not www.
Which was my next bit.
Sorry. Not www.org. You want www.apache.org, and all of the documentation on Apache is actually on www.apache.org. Now, it wasn't called Apache because of the Indians. It was actually called Apache because originally Apache was some code and a patch. So they called it the Apache web server, which then became Apache, because it was originally attached to the original CERN HTTPD web server. I know, nobody other than me cares, but there you go. And I think and the notes are about to say that Apache is the most popular web server on publicly accessible websites on the internet. And you can go and look at Netcraft surveys to verify that. Very, very, very popular stuff. Lots of people want to learn how to use Apache because it is free and it's the coolest web server out there. And not very many people actually succeed because they don't want to put the effort into learning it.
Yeah.
So you're going to say something, Elise?
No, I was just agreeing with you because you can get some things like Webmin that will help you along the way, that will do some configuration with Apache, but there's nothing like getting your Apache configuration file open in a text editor and getting the manual out
having
and going
a play.
For it. Having a play, yeah, I've done that. Oh, it's good fun.
Yeah.
And which is how I got Kerry's little thing in the exam that wanted his tilde slash tilde. File happening. There you go, because I think with Fedora it doesn't come as a default, so you go and learn, look it all up and make it happen.
That wasn't deliberate. Debian actually does do it by default. And
yes, I saw Geordie do that. No, it wasn't deliberate. I saw Geordie do it and she just did whatever she had to do and it went, whereas Fedora it's not switched on by default, so there you go. Interesting.
Now Linux automatically starts your FTP daemon during your boot process. After that, you can remotely FTP to the machine at any time. So when you've logged on to a Linux machine using FTP, you are taken to the home directory. And you can, as an administrator, you could create directories at that stage. The root directory appears in the FTP user account as at the top of the system directory structure, but it won't allow higher access within that structure. Telnet also is another command that you'll need to know. It allows a remote user to log on to a system, and now you'll be doing telnetting and all sorts of fun things as we go along in your labs. And it allows you to remotely manage network servers, all of your services that are on that network service too. Now what it does is the server listens for requests, the Telnet server, and then when it hears requests, it then responds to those requests. Now if, for example, you had a hacker trying to get into the system, they tried to get in, they can't get in, then the server could, now we're talking security here, still be vulnerable to something like a denial of service attack. Now, this is in your test, by the way. What happens then is that the denial of service attack typically involves flooding the server with fake requests and then preventing the server from responding to legitimate sources. And Telnet itself isn't secure. So, for example, Telnet would send usernames and passwords in clear text, so they could be read by others who might be on their network. Now, there is a more secure alternative to Telnet, and that's the Secure Shell, or SSH. And I know that Kerry has talked about SSH a number of times. Now, a lot of organisations will prefer SSH in place of Telnet for that reason. As it encrypts all your passwords and has a number of other security features. Now, most of your Unix systems are going to run Telnet daemons by default, but, you know, obviously...
Yeah.
Well, I know, that's old stuff, but yeah. But because of security now, SSH is a lot more popular. Now, something else we need to talk about is the server message blocks, or SMB protocols. Now, what that is it a protocol that allows, is a file sharing protocol, and it's been since renamed to Common Internet File Systems. And it's obviously, as it sounds, a file system sharing process or protocol. And what it's used for is to allow non-Linux or Unix systems to mount Linux file systems and printers over the network. SMB works much the same way. Now, Linux has also got a tool called Samba. And what Samba does is it gives the Linux system the ability to interact with Windows systems, and it comes with all major Linux distributions.
And the reason it was written, interestingly enough, just as a matter of course, was a fellow by the name of Andrew Trigell.
I'll just carry on while Kerry's sorting that out. Oh, he sorted that out. And keyboard sitting on a braille display. Okay, similar to the SMB or the file sharing protocols.
Hang on, I'm back. I was just going to say, the reason that Andrew Trigell wrote it, Samba, was so that his wife could back up her Word documents on his Linux server. Isn't love grand?
You feel like getting out the maracas. The click, 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 da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Well, he actually went looking through the dictionary for letters that contain the... He used the grep command to look for words that contain the letters S, M, and B. And Samba was the one that came up. And there was a third-party program for the Mac that used to work under OS X 9 and earlier, and it was called Rumba. And it also... It, apparently, you could Samba or you could Rumba. So, there you go.
Okay, now network file sharing is the preferred way of sharing files when you've got Linux or Unix systems, and it allows access to the network file shares on a network file share server. So that's very useful. Okay, now when you're setting up email on your Linux system, you've got a number of choices available to you, as you do in Windows, and the type of email you select will depend on the way you're accessing, what type of modem you're using. Hopefully you're not using dial-up, but if you are, you'll have to consider that or whichever type of access you're using.
Interestingly enough, in Australia, this is a morbid point of interest, you can actually get $10 a month internet access through TADAUST, TADAUST, and they'll actually give you $10 a month dial-up access to the internet, which makes internet access affordable for low-income disabled people, just out of interest, since you mentioned modems.
So, if you were working as an administrator and you're wanting to set up an email daemon on Linux, you'd need to set up the mail user agent, which we refer to on as the mailer. You'd also need a mail transfer agent and a transport protocol. I nearly said transperth protocol. Transport protocol. What the mailer provides you with is an interface that allows you to read and compose messages. And the mail is used to transfer the mail from the sender to your recipient and back again. And then you've got your transfer protocol. As it sounds, it allows you to transfer.
And that is now, in the practical exam.
It is. Now, if you're setting up printers in your Linux environment, you need to know a little bit about editing and configuring your print files, and you need to sort of do your research a little bit there to work with the particular system that you're on.
You probably want to refer to your notes on that one, because the later versions of Red Hat have actually moved towards CUPS, which is configurable with a web interface. But these notes talk about LPR, they talk about LPRNG, and they talk about etc. printcap, which I don't think actually comes up in your labs anywhere, does it, Elise? I didn't think it did.
Sorry, Kerry, I missed that. What were you asking?
PrintCap, etc. PrintCap and LPR. It's not in the labs.
Are they still there? Are they in the labs? Going to test my memory now. I think there was
you
some.
Don't know. I don't think there's a lot on it, though.
There isn't a great deal on print, no. It is mentioned. No. Printing is one of those things that we didn't cover a great deal of. Just as a footnote, and I think I mentioned it in my practical, the Samba demon seemed to pick my printer up out of the box. I didn't seem to have to do a great deal with it when I shared.
That's good.
I seem to think if the driver was on the Windows machine, it actually picks up the printer. Cool. That may not happen for everybody.
Somebody's phone's about to ring. Okay, so you can set up your printer locally or on your server, and then all your print requests get forwarded to the appropriate printer. Okay, something that you will come across and probably have come across if you've used Linux is setting up your printer. You'll end up with jobs that come through, and there'll be print queues, and there'll be a one print queue with every printer that is on your system. Now, the Linux utility that you use to print is called LPR, and that stands for the line printer daemon. And the daemon, the line printer daemon, manages print queues on your print server. And I don't have to say that too often, will I? So when you're setting up your print server, which most cases is going to be in your work environment, you're going to need to know about the LPR NG's print spooling system. And what that is software that gives your server the ability to handle multiple printers and multiple queues. Okay, and there's a number of different commands that are in there on printing. You may have a GUI, or you probably will have a GUI utility that's set up for printing in Linux too, on a Linux server. Now, something else that you need to know about is the Ghost Script Translator. when you're administering your Linux system, you need to know about Ghost Script. The I like that.
Interestingly enough, there is a humorous note in the Ghost Script distribution called humor.txt that actually talks about the fact that there are negotiations with William Shakespeare and other famous historical writers who wish to continue to publish documents in the modern age, and they're hoping that Ghost Script will allow them to do that.
Okay, well, Ghost Script is basically just a translator, and it allows your Linux and Unix systems to talk together. And especially when they're using the PostScript printing language, you know, so they
supports PDF as well.
Yep. Okay, so yeah, it's a translation tool. Okay, scripts. Scripts can be long, complex things in Linux, and they've got a number of different lines of codes that will allow commands or automated commands to take place. So with regard to a shell script, it's just a text file, and it's got a number of Linux commands that get in a list, and they go through one by one. Next line, next line, next line type thing. Okay, now there's some play around there on the hello commands, and that's just to give a play. So have a look at your notes that you can play with on your Linux system. So today's quite in depth, I know. It's important for you to go back and read the notes, because we do give you the basics that you need to know, but there is a lot more in your notes, so do make yourself familiar with what's in the note. Refer to your man pages, do your labs, because your labs are going to be what reinforces all this you know, miles and miles of dialogue into a something that's going to stay in your mind. And also it's something you should enjoy, and playing around with your virtual machines. That was all we had today. So unless we've got any questions from our our favourite people that are sitting in here each week, Elise and Karen. Karen?
Grace.
What's your name?
Karen.
Grace? Where do I get Karen from? I think I'm at the end of 2 hours.
Don't
That's
call me
problem.
Karen.
Don't call. What about amazing?
That's almost as bad as Karen.
Amazing Grace, yes. Okay, so next week we're going to be talking all about servers and, you know, the network servers and that type of thing, and how to manage a network. So it should be a good one too. So thank you for bearing with us today. Unless anyone's got any questions, we'll say adios, amigos. Hasta la vista and all that sort of thing.
You will be back and whatnot.
Until next week, and we will be around on Skype for anyone who would like to talk to us, or anyone who wouldn't like to talk to us for that matter. If you need to talk to us, we're here. So have a good week and a good weekend, and for those in Perth, it's a long weekend. Yahoo!
Are you angling the weekend off? What's your holiday for?
Royal Show.
Oh, Perth Show, is it? Oh, yeah, of course, it's on next week, isn't it?
Yeah, you want to spend the big dollars.
And your show day never got Jeffed. Oh, that's good. Aren't you lucky?
So, yeah. Thanks, everybody.